the morning. Want to share on humility, the hallmark of Christianity. And I think that you will see as we go through the message why I've picked that word. It's not maybe the only hallmark of Christianity, but it's a very significant one. Our text this morning comes from James chapter 4, verse 6. But he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And we'll eventually get to that passage. On the outset, I want to define some terms at the beginning of the message here. And the first one we're going to talk about is the word hallmark in the title. And that's a mark that's stamped on articles of gold, silver, or platinum in Britain, certifying their standard of purity. That's where we get the term from. I did not know that. And as that word has been assimilated into our language, now to us it means a distinctive feature, especially one of excellence. There's a little history behind this. Apparently, centuries ago, King Edward I of England decreed that gold and silver had to be tested and approved by master craftsmen before being sold. Later, London artisans were required to bring finished metal goods to the goldsmith's hall to be checked, and if those items met the quality standards of the craftmasters there, they would be marked with a special stamp of approval. And at first, people used hallmark to name that mark of excellence from the goldsmith's hall, but over the years the word came to refer to any mark guaranteeing purity or genuineness. And eventually to name any sign of outstanding talent, creativity, or excellence. And so I don't know what you think of when you think of hallmark. Maybe you think of a card here in the United States, but it's a mark of excellence. Okay? The second word I want to define is humble, and that's having or showing a modest or low estimate of one's own importance. And it comes, of course, from the Latin word humus, which means ground. And that's why when you talk about humility, some of the synonyms in the Bible are low, and why you see people down on their knees, and You've got to get down low with humility. And humility, of course, is just a modest or low view of one's own importance, a different tense. And if you're going to talk about humility, you're going to have to talk about the antonym as well, which is pride. And not all pride is bad. The dictionary definition of pride is a feeling or deep pleasure or satisfaction derived from one's own achievements, the achievements of those with whom one is closely associated, or from qualities or possessions that are widely admired. It's also the quality of having an excessive high opinion of oneself or one's importance. And in Hebrew, the Hebrew word that's translated humble in our Bible literally means to boil or to seethe. Did I say humble? Pride. The Hebrew word that's translated pride means literally to boil, to seethe. And so I don't know if you can get a little bit of a picture of what's happening in pride. The Greek word that's translated pride can mean pride, haughtiness, arrogance, the characteristic of one who with a swollen estimate of his own powers or merits looks down on others and even treats them with insolence and contempt. So there's pride and humility, and there's a pretty big contrast between the two. But I thought that Hebrew definition of pride, or the literal meaning of the Hebrew word for pride, boiling, is really, that really stood out to me. And so, the first point I titled, Seeing Who I Am. And I'm going to talk about pride a little bit first. The origin of pride comes directly from Satan. And you can see that in Ezekiel 28, if you want to look there. You don't have to. Ezekiel 28. And I'm not going to read straight through the passage. I'm going to skip some verses here. Starting in verse 12, he tells Ezekiel, "Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre and say to him, 'Thus says the Lord God, you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty.'" And it becomes pretty obvious when you read down here that he's not really talking about the king of Tyre. He's talking about something else. And if I skip down to verse 17, after he talks about how he was perfect and everything was just so amazing, "Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you." And so, apparently Satan thought that he was so beautiful and so wonderful that he could lift his heart up against the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And that's where pride entered the world, right there at that moment. And the world has really never been the same ever since. And so, of course, you know, he was cast out of heaven and he came down and tempted man. And I think that first temptation appealed to man's pride as well. And, you know, really all pride is exalting ourselves against God. That's what it is. And that can take many, many different avenues. C.S. Lewis said, "Pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind." So when you have this mindset of pride, it's as anti-God as you can get. And you know, God is not full of pride. And that's important to remember as we see God high and lifted up. But as Dale read this morning, he's very willing to humble himself and look down at us. And, you know, pride, as I said, it takes on many forms. And sometimes it makes people arrogant and hard to be around. And they right off that they think far too much of themselves and who they are. But it also affects us in many different ways. It makes you insecure because you're so worried about what other people are going to think. And that can lead you down many roads. Many, many things. People who are insecure become bullies to try to cover up their insecurity. They shrink back in a corner and they're a wallflower because if I say anything wrong or I do anything wrong, people are going to look down at me. And that's a very brief overview. And I have had a whole message about that, what insecurity can do to you. But I think that the first step to acquire humility is to see who I really am. And to admit that I have this pride problem. And if you want to see who you are, you got to have something to compare yourself to. Because if I just look at me, I'm pretty good. If I don't have anybody else to compare myself to, I'm the best. The wisest, the smartest. But we know that that's not true. If I just start comparing myself with other people, I can very quickly find people who are more intelligent or more athletic or more handsome. But of course, we're going to compare ourselves today with the gold standard, which is God. And I think that somehow in our Christian experience, we're going to have to get a vision of God, of who God really is, just like Isaiah did. He saw God. He was high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple, and that had an immediate effect on how Isaiah perceived himself. And I think we're going to have to come up against that. We're going to have to come up against this high and lifted up God, the God whose throne is above all other thrones, whose intelligence is beyond all human intellect, whose power is beyond all human power. You just look at the universe. Did you ever do this? Go out at night, if you can find a darker place than Shippensburg to do it, and look up at the stars and think about how many billions of them there are and how far away they are, and think about where you are. Pretty small in comparison just to the universe, let alone to the God who created it, who makes it hold together and work. He says in Isaiah that the nations are like a drop in the bucket. Where are we as individuals? What are we like compared to God? That's for me is the quickest way to get a little bit of an idea where I am compared to God. And the next point I want to make is that genuine love is inseparable from humility. And I had never thought about this before. I've been thinking about this. Have you ever experienced arrogant love? Have you? If you do experience that, you're going to say, well, that's not love. That's something, we're not sure what it is. It's a fake. Because genuine love isn't arrogant. And that's what he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4. Love endures with patience and serenity. This is out of the Amplified. Love is kind and thoughtful and is not jealous or envious. Love does not brag and is not proud or arrogant. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not provoked nor overly sensitive and easily angered. It does not take into account a wrong endured. It does not rejoice at injustice, but rejoices with the truth. So we have this picture of this love that's, if you're going to love, you're going to be humble. Because if I'm loving you and you have an achievement, I'm going to rejoice with you in that. It's not, it doesn't seek to pull itself up. That's not love. If you see that happening, then it's a fake. Whoever's loving you that way isn't really loving you. Not at all. Well, then I want to look at Christ as our perfect example in humility. And he personified humility for us. And we see that in Philippians chapter 2, and Dale already read part of this. Philippians chapter 2, beginning at verse 5, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant, and coming in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. So we have this God that was sitting on this throne, one of these great, big, high thrones that's above everything. And he humbled himself and came down and took on human flesh, was born as a little infant, about this long and about this high. And I don't know what kind of a transition that must have been like. But that's humbling yourself. And he did that for us. And the other passage I want to look at, giving an example of Christ's humility, is in John chapter 13. A very familiar passage. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll read verses 1 to 5. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. And then we'll skip over the conversation he had with Peter and pick up in verse 12. So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, "Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are ye if you do them." And this passage always speaks to me when we read it before our feet washing service. And he says, "Do you know what I have done to you?" And you know, right before this, I think, I didn't look it up, but I think right before this, they had been arguing about who was going to be the greatest. And you know, he didn't counter their argument with an argument. He served them. He humbled himself and gave an example to them and to us today. If the Lord of heaven and earth can stoop to wash dirty feet, what an example is that to us in serving each other. And I don't think he was as concerned about the feet as he was about the attitude of humility and service. And I would say that if you have a problem with pride, the best antidote is to go and serve somebody. And that's going to make a big difference in how you look at it, how you look at your brother, your friend, your neighbor, your family, whoever that is. And there he says, if the master is doing this, the servant's not greater than the master, so we need to follow his example. Well, what is our part? Try to get a little bit more practical here. What is our part? When a man asked George Mueller the secret of his service, Mueller responded, "There was a day when I died, utterly died, died to George Mueller, his opinions, preferences, taste, and will, died to the world, its approval or censure, died to the approval or blame even of my brethren and friends, and since then I have studied to show myself approved only to God." So George Mueller came to a point in his life where only God mattered to him. His reputation didn't matter. What other people thought about him didn't matter. His own opinions didn't even matter. Whatever God wanted, that was what he was going to do. And C.S. Lewis says, "Do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who is always telling you that, of course, he is nobody. Probably all you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all." And finally, that is the secret of humility. It's getting to the place where we aren't thinking about us. And William Temple says the same thing. Humility does not mean thinking less of yourself than of other people, nor does it mean having a low opinion of your own gifts. It means freedom from thinking about yourself at all. We'll have a long ways to go when it comes to this task. But I think that's the key. If we can somehow get rid of ourselves in this whole equation, then we're going to be able to experience true freedom. Freedom to serve God the way He wants us to. Freedom from the chains of needing someone else's approval. We do all kinds of crazy things to get other people's approval. It can affect the kind of car you buy, the kind of house you have, whether you mow your grass on Monday or Saturday, all the way up and down. And you know, we won't have to follow what the fads and the fashions are because we're not worried about it. And then some people like to say, well, whatever it was that I did, if you compliment me for it, well, that was nothing. Or, you know, I just don't, I'm not all that great. Well, that's not humility either, because that's a preoccupation with me again. And we got a children's book here a while ago about Uncle Rocky the firefighter. And Uncle Rocky is a fairly smart young fella. And he suggests some things and does some things on the firefighting crew that save people's lives, save people's money, save the environment. And when he gets complimented for that, at the end of the story, he always says, I was glad to do it. And I really like that idea. I was glad to do it. And I think that in our circles, we're maybe slow to compliment people because we're scared we're going to make them big-headed. Well, we're pretty quick to criticize, though, because we don't worry about making someone feel proud if we're criticizing them. Let's give people the encouragement. If they've done a good job, let's say so. And hopefully, you know, you can deal with that. And do like this man did. Samuel Brangle was an early Salvation Army office official who was once introduced as the great Dr. Brangle. He later wrote in his diary, "If I appear great in their eyes, the Lord is most graciously helping me to see how absolutely nothing I am without Him, and helping me to keep little in my own eyes. He does use me, but I am so concerned that He uses me and that it is not of me that the work is done. The axe cannot boast of the trees it has cut down. It could do nothing but for the woodsman. He made it, he sharpened it, and he used it. The moment he throws it aside, it becomes only old iron. Oh, that I may never lose sight of this." And so if you're on the receiving end of the praise, I was glad to do it. I'm glad that you were blessed. But it's God doing it through me. And I don't know if you need to say that, but that's the way it works. We just have nothing to bring to the table. It's God's empowerment through us. You know, something I was thinking about when I prepared this message, you guys all probably know what a graph is. I use graphs all the time in my work. Graph these numbers on my scan tool. And you know, with the graph, they have, this is time. And this is the value that you're looking at in my graphs. And when I drive the car down the road, I'm looking for something. And a graph really helps me to visualize this. So if this is the amount of humility this way, and this is the time that I'm a Christian this way, we want to see it go, you know, maybe there'll be some waves, but hopefully, you know, after we've been a Christian for a while, we can see that increase. should always be increasing, the level of humility in our lives. And there's maybe not a good set of numbers to quantify that, like you can look at oxygen sensor voltage or fuel trim or something like that. But maybe that can be the testimony of our lives. And there will be some fluctuations as we go because we're far from perfect. Well, finally, I want to talk about the effects of humility. And get in here too. You can get back to James. James chapter 4. Spend just a little bit of time here in James. And I'm gonna just break in here. He's talking in the first part of this chapter about where the wars and the fightings come that are among us. And he says in verse 6, but he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, submit to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. And dropping down to verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. And so I just want to think for a minute about this first part. God resists the proud. Well, I don't know about you, but if you run into resistance, it makes it harder to go. And if you run into God's resistance, you're going to hit a block wall. You're just not going to go anymore. And so if you've got a proud heart, God is going to actively push you around. He's going to push you. And he's going to try to get you to humble yourself. But that's a choice that you have to make. God is not going to force you to be humble. God will not force you to come down off of your high horse, as they say, and get down on the ground where you need to be. He gives us free will. And he gives us free will in this. We can choose to be proud, choose to humble ourselves. But he's going to resist you. And every time you come up against something, there's going to be a resistance there. And not only that, but since he only gives grace to the humble, if you think you're going to live your Christian life in pride, I've got another thought coming to you. It's not going to happen. You're going to have failure after failure after failure after failure because the grace of God can't be applied to your life. He gives grace to the humble. He does not give grace to the proud. And so he says, submit to God. And submit means to come under. To say, God, you're the boss. I'm the soldier. You're the general. And there's a huge amount of freedom when we do that. And it's interesting because he says, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. And I think that by the wording of that, if you're not willing to submit to God, you're not going to have much resistance to the devil, and he certainly isn't going to flee from you. But when the devil sees somebody who's humbled themselves, and God's pouring grace into their life, he doesn't have any choice. He's going to flee. And so he says, draw near to God, and God's going to come near to you. You've got to make that little first step. You've got to get down off of the horse and down onto your knees before God. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. He is going to lift you up. And when God lifts you up, it's going to be in the right way. You're not going to struggle with pride over God lifting you up. It's not going to happen. And I think that humility is the single most important asset that the Christian has. Because when we humble ourselves, we can expect a flow of grace to come from God through us. And I think if we're struggling with anger or with purity or with our speech or with many other things, we need to examine our lives and say, is there an area in my life that I'm proud? Is there an area in my life that I am anti-God? That I'm not letting God have? And if we can humble ourselves, I think that we're going to make progress like this graph. Make progress. And James, you know, this submission and then resisting the devil. And the other thing I think about humility is that it's the key to all of our interpersonal relationships. If you want to have a good relationship with somebody, you don't go there with pride and arrogance. You go in there and you want to listen. You want to hear what that person has to say. And then you can act upon that in a humble way. And if we can get this under our belts, I think it's going to make our church a better place, our homes a better place, our workplaces. And I think that, I don't know how to express that, but I just have a burden for our group that we would humble ourselves and seek the face of God together. And that our church would be, receive that benefit. Well, may God bless you this week as you seek Him in humility. And as you do, may you find the grace, His grace and power unleashed in your life. Any comments or feedback about the message?